Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Orlando Science Center, presenting Life, an all-new exhibit on nature and conservation. Animals are the real storytellers of life's three distinct environments: rainforest, ocean, and swamp, with hands-on experiential learning that vividly demonstrates humanity's interconnectedness with the natural world. More at osc.org.
Mini moon rovers and communicating in deep space. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Marion Summerall, filling in for Brendan Byrne. A trio of small rovers will launch to the moon as early as this year to collect data and test to see if they can successfully work together as a team without a lot of help from Earth. We'll speak with two researchers about how these mini moon rovers will change the future of space exploration. Then another company is working on developing new technology to help with deep space communication. The Italian-based aerospace company Argotec is working to create satellite payloads that will help with communications in deep space and even around other planets. We'll hear from the company's general manager about the efforts to communicate in deep space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? A trio of rovers will blast off on a mission to map the lunar surface as early as this year, with little help from mission planners back here on Earth. The Cadre rovers will act as a team on the moon, but their mission is autonomous. The rovers are even able to select a leader as they complete different tasks. Although they are independent, they will be sending data and images back to Earth during the mission. But this kind of technology could inspire future robotic missions on the moon and possibly one day other planets. Here to talk more about these mini rovers is Cadre's program manager, Shubha Commander, and principal investigator, Jean-Pierre Delacroix. Shubha, JP, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how big are some of these rovers in comparison to some of the other rovers, let's say on Mars? You know, how big are these rovers and what do they look like?
So these rovers are about a carry-on suitcase size. So you could fit them in a carry-on suitcase. They weigh about 9 kilos each.
Wow. So they are really tiny.
They are. And they are tiny because we wanted to send many of them, more of them, right? So we have 3 rovers and a base station. So we want to fit more of these rovers as a team.
And what location are they going to on the moon? Is it specific and why there?
So as far as I understand, Rainer Gamma was selected as part of the Eclipse program. The mission location was kind of selected for all of the payloads that are going as part of IM3, not, you know, specifically just for Cadre.
And it's in the equatorial region of the moon, and it has these sort of light and dark swirls in the regolith that's supposed to be very interesting for science.
What is the mission of the rovers while they are up there on the moon?
It's a technology demonstration to show how a team of these rovers, these mobile robots, can work together. They can coordinate and work together and perform a task without humans in the loop. So cooperatively and autonomously.
Wow, that is really interesting. So they're autonomous, but they work together. How are they working together as a team?
So when we mean work together, it really is kind of the case of rather than us individually telling each robot what they should be doing at a certain time, we actually just command the team as a whole. So we tell them, for example, go explore this area near the lander. And then from everything onwards, it's fully autonomous. As a team, they select a leader. The leader thinks about, okay, what's the best way to split up this problem into 3 pieces? And then it coordinates among all the rovers to tell them, okay, you're going to take this region, you're going to take this other region. They go off and they use their sensors to kind of build a map of the area. And then they use their radios to communicate all that data and kind of built up this map from all the little pieces that they each gathered into the larger thing that they then send back to us on Earth.
You said they select a leader. How is the leader selected? Is it randomized?
Okay, so they select it every time they kind of start a new task or job, if you will, right? So they basically make sure that there's somebody that's in charge of deciding how the work is going to get done, and in some ways also supervise it, right? Because the tasks might take a little bit of time and things might change. So you always need somebody that can on the team that can kind of monitor that and make decisions and plan for the team throughout their task. But that's not determined like, you know, back here on Earth. That's really something that they do amongst themselves to kind of self-organize.
The leader tells the team what to do. For example, one of the tasks we might give them is drive in formation. But each rover still has the smarts to avoid like rocks and obstacles in its way. So each rover is still problem solving at its level while still following what the team is doing.
Wow, fascinating, truly. And why is it so important we have these robots that don't need as much human help? What can we look forward to if this test works well?
Yeah, these robots can work with humans, even though and take away a lot of the tedious tasks that we don't want the astronauts to do, right? To help with construction, in situ, mining for resources and looking for resources, mapping areas, exploring previously unexplored areas, or going into more extreme terrain that we wouldn't want to send the astronauts into. But the fact that they work together means they can take measurements at the same time, but separated in different places. And that actually opens up a whole new way of doing science. You get a whole new dimension of data when you're taking multiple measurements at the same time, but in different places.
How do you prevent them from doing things that you don't want them to do? How do you program them so they are on this set schedule?
We do communicate with the system, right? But I think how I what I mentioned earlier was really that the point is not to kind of micromanage them, but really just provide them with the general instructions of what we want them to do as a team. So think of it as like the mission objectives that we hand to them. And then certainly, they also on a continuous basis send us back data to Earth. So we're going to be, you know, watching that as they go about their jobs to go, you know, we want to look at the data that they're seeing. We want to see what kind of decisions that they're making. How are they making these decisions, right? Because this is really a technology demonstration. So we're trying to learn as much as we can about how these robots work together autonomously so that we can then understand how to use that technology in the future for all the kinds of missions that Ashuba also talked about.
We also have a camera on the lander, kind of like a yard monitor that looks over the rovers and sees what they're doing. So we get that data back to the Earth while they're doing the experiments.
So they can problem solve is what you were saying?
The tasks that they're given have kind of constraints that define, you know, what can you do within that task. So there, it's not a completely open-ended problem that we're giving them, but rather we're saying, hey, go explore within this region. And then certainly there's always what we tend to call full protection. Like if something were to go wrong with one of the robots on board, they have kind of a safety layer that makes sure that they, for example, stop driving so they don't, you know, like one robot just doesn't decide to, you know, drive away or something like that. What's actually also really interesting is that the rest of the team adjusts when one of the other rovers has a problem, right? They kind of decide, okay, well, one of my, you know, teammates is not able to do what we asked them to do, but we can, you know, replan and compensate for that and continue to operate, which is also a very kind of important aspect that these robots are working together, but are resilient even if they, you know, run into some challenges.
You mentioned the rocks and avoiding things like that, and the moon has a really harsh environment. How are you preparing these rovers for the moon's environment and for the ride into space to get there?
Yeah, there's various aspects. So we do a lot. The short answer is by testing. So we have equivalent testing that we do on the Earth. We subject these rovers to the same vibration that they're going to see during launch. We subject them to the temperature extremes that they're going to see both during the cruise phase as well as on the surface of the moon. We've come up with a design and analysis that we know will work, and then we test them to verify that they will work. So they survive the harsh environments of vibration, the temperature. On the moon, we also have an added environment of dust. There's a lot of moon dust that can come and accumulate on our solar panels or cameras, for example, and prevent the rovers from fully functioning. So we also protect against that.
And I would also say from an autonomy perspective, there's, you know, testing that we do here on Earth that really helps the robots, you know, prepare for for their time on the moon. So things like we go out on into the JPL Mars Yard and we set up rocks and little craters to try to simulate what the moon could look like at our landing site. Or we go and we do some of our testing at nighttime with spotlights so that you can reproduce the, you know, the harsher lighting conditions that you have on the moon. So we basically try to test as much as we can here on Earth to build up our confidence before we send them out on their mission. Basically, what we want to make sure is that we didn't just design algorithms that, for example, only work with three robots. So even if you go from three robots to a team of two, the algorithms that they're executing still work. And in the same way, if we, for example, were to fly this technology with more robots, it would also, you would be able to take what we have done on Cadre and extend it to a larger team as well. So there's flexibility in you know, the size of the team when you go and do these kind of tasks on the moon.
And they passed some of those tests recently, right? This is the third mission from Intuitive Machines. How are you both feeling about this upcoming mission? Is it nerve-wracking? Is it exciting?
I will say that I am more excited than nervous. I know, I mean, we've had great engineers. We have a great team, both at JPL and at Intuitive Machines, working on this. It's very exciting, definitely. I mean, as with any space mission, there's always unknowns, you know, that we can't always prepare for. But knowing that we have put our best foot forward, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I'm also in the camp of just extremely excited. Even for me personally, it's really kind of a dream come true because I've been working on multi-agent systems and multi-agent autonomy since, you know, when I was an undergrad in college, and I'm, you know, finally having the opportunity to work with a fantastic team to make that a real thing in space. So it's just beyond exciting.
Now that some of the testing is complete, what can we look forward to with these Cadre rovers?
Well, first of all, certainly the technology demonstration itself, right? I think that's going to be, like we talked about, incredibly exciting. And then I think Shubha also mentioned, you know, we're really going to provide an example of a team of rovers that are working together autonomously. And from there, our hope is really that there's going to be almost a, you know, kind of a new explosion of lots of different missions that are now, you know, considering, you know, what can we do with multiple robots? Like, what does it enable for us to go explore our solar system when I've got, you know, more than just one robot? You know, what can I do differently? So that's really our hope, is that we provide a spark to everyone's imagination about how you can explore our solar system.
Yeah, I think that's the game-changing part, is it'll change the way we explore in the future to say, how many rovers should we be sending and what can they do together? And that'll change how we explore in the future. And this doesn't have to be the autonomy software, the algorithms that's being developed for Cadre isn't necessarily just specific for rovers. You can imagine a future mission where you have a combination of rovers and drones and helicopters, and they're all working together. So there's, you know, the possibilities are endless.
Really stepping into the future with these rovers. JP, Shubha, thank you both for coming on the show. And I can't wait to see these mini moon rovers take off to the moon.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Still to come, communicating farther into space than we ever have before with new transponders. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Marion Summerall, filling in for Brennan Byrne. An Italian space company is trying to develop new technology that will aid future planetary missions as humanity tries to explore our solar system like never before. ArgoTech has been working on developing small transponders called UST Light to help stay connected as we explore deep space. Here to talk about these transponders is Corbett Hunginger, the general manager for ArgoTech. Corbett, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
ArgoTech is working on some pretty interesting communication satellites. And for some of our listeners who may not know, can you give a little background on ArgoTech and this new mission to really make this new groundbreaking project?
So ArgoTech has been around for 15 years. It's one of the companies that most people have never really heard of, but they know what we've done, interesting enough. Some of the big things that we've done in space are NASA DART mission. NASA ran into an asteroid on purpose with a satellite to see if they could adjust its trajectory, kind of in a doomsday scenario. Well, if you Google it, all the images that you see were actually our satellite that went along with it, and we took all the images in deep space. And so we've got a real big history about supporting space, whether it's human space flight or deep space. And so we've been establishing ourselves in the U.S., and we have a technology transfer that we've obtained with the Jet Propulsion Lab, JPL, which is we're building a next-generation deep space transponder with them. It's called UST Light, so it's a smaller version of the deep space transponder. And this is going to enable the next generation of deep space communication, which is vital for our future as we're continuing to get beyond low Earth orbit.
Why is satellite communication so important? Why is this specifically going to be so groundbreaking?
Yeah, so if you think about, you know, I try to do analogies for a lot of different things. And so you think about it on Earth, right? You know, how did we really get, you know, New York to talk to California or the, you know, the U.S., to talk to Europe, and we had to have this communication infrastructure to be able to do it. And if we wanted to get around the planet, we had to have these communication satellites. The satellite system we have right now is really designed for Earth. It's all for low Earth orbit and to bounce signals from space to Earth, and nothing's really designed for deep space, lunar, Mars, or any of these other things. And so we really need to kind of invest into an architecture, the infrastructure, if you will, for the moon, for Mars, for deep space, to be able to build up a communication network. And like a big master plan community, you really need to think ahead of time to make sure these things all work together. Because as we get more and more out there and we get, the technology gets better, we collect a lot more data. Well, a lot more data means you need a lot more communication, or you need a bigger bandwidth, but a bigger bandwidth means you need more power. And so these things are all building up on each other. And so if you take a look at the communication network, really needs to focus on how are we doing edge computing in space? Because do we need to take everything and send it down so we can minimize the communication signal that we need? How are we doing what we call PNT, position, navigation, and tracking? We saw with the intuitive machines that just landed, we really don't have a good way to be able to navigate and land on the moon or even navigate around it in many cases. But a communication system, if you do it right, it can actually provide a pseudo-type GPS system as well. And then, of course, it provides communication. It'll give us communication. You know, think about the backside of the moon. How does the backside of the moon, the communication we have from the moon right now is direct to Earth. Well, if you're in the backside and you never face Earth, you can't get communication. Or if you're in the pole of the moon, how do you get communication? You might have limited spots when you can see something. So you really need to invest and build up this architecture to enable everything we want to do for human spatial exploration or probes.
And especially with the upcoming moon missions and everything that we're doing, right? I mean, that's what you were kind of hinting at, is it's so important. So they just got in touch with the Voyager. So could this new technology help with things like that and with the Voyager too?
Well, so it could potentially help with the Voyager, but you know, the Voyager is a really old system, and it's designed so that it can take its message and send it a long way. It's a lower signal but it can help with things like future voyages, right? So if you think about a software-defined radio versus a hardware-defined radio, one of the things they were able to do with Voyager is they found an error on board and they were able to switch over how it's doing its comm to another area, and that's how they were able to reestablish it. Well, most of the communication things we have today are coded radios and you can't change over. Well, the next generation one we're working on is software-defined radios. So you can change frequencies in the software, or you can change bands for a narrower width or a wider width band to help communication. So again, think about, you know, say we're putting a probe on Mars. Well, what happens when Mars is behind the sun compared to the Earth? You don't have that direct line of sight.
They call it the spring break for the Mars rovers.
Yeah, so if you had a relay system out there, it could talk to the relay, and then the relay could bring that back to Earth, and now you don't get a spring break, unfortunately for the rover.
Right. Okay, so really looking ahead towards the future, which, you know, again, is so important as we really take that deep dive into more space exploration. Are there any challenges to this that you found? Is there anything that you're working, you know, to get past?
First of all, you know, space as a service is very expensive. And you don't get an ROI, return on investment, until you get it operating. So that means it's a big financial investment for the companies to be able to do this. Satellites are around, and we know how to make satellites, and we know how to put them in orbit, and we know how to send them to the moon, and we can build radios. So the technology itself isn't difficult, but space is difficult. You got to get it up there. There's a whole infrastructure and the whole cost around that. And that's really the biggest thing in order to be able to get this enabled, right? And as we see, even, you know, the two things with NASA and the CLPS mission lately was the Peregrine and also the Odysseus. And both of them were somewhat successful, but also failed. Peregrine didn't complete its mission. Odysseus didn't stick the landing, right, because it didn't have a good way to navigate. And so there's lots of challenges that are along the way, but the technology itself really isn't difficult.
So let's talk about how you're testing this, right? You said, you know, you don't really see the benefits until it's up there. So, you know, you can't just fly to space, test it out real quick, and hop back onto Earth. So kind of run me through how you're testing this.
You know, you kind of build it up in spots and kind of, you know, just kind of put it together, right? So right now we're working on the radio with JPL, and JPL will probably be the one of the first users of the radio, and we'll get that certified and for use in space. We're building our satellite platforms for other missions. And again, we're certifying our platforms on other missions, and they're getting certified that way. Now I have two products that have been certified through different means, and I can put them together and deploy them, right? And so it's kind of the way you do this. You just build it up slowly, you know, and again, this takes a little bit more time, because if we were to just put it into space, then we'd be like, you know, well, hopefully this works. But also you kind of still have to do that. And that's why you have these things called Pathfinder missions. The vision is for us is that if we launch a couple and we see as a Pathfinder, and then we can, in a couple of years, launch a couple more and a couple more, and you keep adding to it, but you also add more and more functionality. And so you take smaller satellites that are designed to only last 5 years versus these giant satellites that are designed to last 20 to 30 years. And what that helps you is it helps you get it to the market faster, deploy them faster. They're cheaper to build and deploy. But also, you know, every couple of years, you can keep adding to it and getting more and more capability added. So the first time we do it, we're probably only going to have communication. But the next ones we have will actually add the pseudo GPS type stuff that we were talking about.
How do you feel working on equipment like this? I mean, it sounds extremely futuristic. How do you feel working on stuff like this?
Well, I'm super excited about it. I spent my whole career working in space. I started off working human space flight, you know, training astronauts for the space shuttle and space station missions and working mission control. Then I transitioned over and was working on the next generation human spacecraft, Dream Chaser, which a cargo spacecraft. And this is just the next evolution of that. So everything, you know, I've done in my career has been, how do we help out humanity and really the human spaceflight aspect? And this is just another piece of it. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, to be at the forefront of this is always greatly exciting.
And to see that development from the shuttle to, you know, now and Dream Chaser, is it weird almost looking back on kind of when you started to where this technology is going? I mean, did you expect that we would be here 20 years ago?
Well, in all honesty, you know, as naive as I was when I first started, I thought I would be farther along. You know? I believe, you know, everybody has these ideas of grandeur, like, wow, yeah, we can do this and we can do this. But then once you really get into it and you start doing the design and you understand why it takes so long, because space is unforgiving, because the more you have to add for robustness or what we call redundancy, the longer it takes. And so to be as far as we are today, actually, the now me is impressed where we are today. You know, versus the young me who would think that we are way far behind.
Again, Argo Tech has been doing some incredible things with these satellites and also designing the espresso machine for the ISS. You know, what's next?
By the way, you know, you mentioned espresso machine and the ISS. So, you know, it's a funny thing, a little bit of history of Argo Tech is they actually started off training astronauts for ESA for the space station missions. And they took an opportunity where a lot of the Italian astronauts were, I won't say complaining, but complaining that they couldn't get a real espresso or even a cup of coffee aboard the International Space Station. It's all freeze-dried. So they took that opportunity and teamed up with Lavazza and created an honest-to-God espresso machine for the International Space Station, which is still flying today. And then they've, you know, continued to grow and said, okay, what else is need out there? And they looked for opportunities. So we're always looking for opportunities, including even, you know, continuing with our background in human spaceflight. You know, one of the big needs we see in the future for human spaceflight is how are people going to, you know, eat on board the space stations, right? The current way they do it is they have the freeze-dried food and they add the water to it, you know, and that's good, but, you know, that's old-fashioned. What can you do in the new world to take it up and modernize it, right? Can you think of, you know, we're thinking of things like having a space vending machine almost. You know, if you look in like Japan, you have these things where you can put your money in and it makes your noodles for you right there and it's all fresh and ready to go. Imagine having something like that aboard a habitat, a space habitat, where, you know, you can pre-plan your meals and you can just hit your button and it makes it for you. So we're always looking to the future of what can we do to enhance and make, you know, life more comfortable for the human spaceflight participants. And also, how do we enable them to do more things like the lunar communication?
Well, if I ever get to space and I see a vending machine there that can make me a hot meal, I think that will be the best part as I'm looking down at Earth. Corbett Hunginger is the general manager of Argo Tech, Inc. Corbett, thank you so much for coming on the show today. And I cannot wait to hear more about what Argo Tech is doing.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the conversation.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our host is Brennan Byrne. Our producer is me, Marion Summerall. Our intern is Sophie Diaz. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Marion Summerall. Thanks for listening.